Oasis Podcast, episode 13, The Return of the King, Liam Gallagher's Back, a discussion with Chris from the Stage Left Podcast, and an interview with Vivek Tiwari. Welcome to episode 13 of the Oasis podcast. I was about to say the Stage Left podcast. No, it's not. It's the Oasis podcast. Thank you so much for all the comments on the last episode, which was with Steve White. What a great guy Steve White is. Every episode now just seems to be me saying, oh, what a great guy the last guest was. Well, I'm very lucky in that all the guests have generally been really, really nice. So thank you so much to Steve White. What a legend he is. And yeah, and as he talked about on the last episode, look out for the Family Silver when they tour later in the year. What an incredible time to be an Oasis podcast. I mean, this last week, just to let you know, I'm recording this on the 2nd of June, Friday the 2nd of June. And it has just been a mad week. I'll be getting on, you'll be hearing shortly from Chris from the Stage Left podcast, who is a massive Oasis fan. If you heard a previous episode with him, which was episode 8, he explained his history with Oasis. He loves them, and the big inspiration for him doing the Stage Left podcast was going and interviewing people connected to Oasis. So, and he was at the Brixton gig, so we're going to be talking about that. But just taking it back a little bit, I mean, the week started... I mentioned in the last episode very briefly, really, about that terrible atrocity in Manchester that happened. And when anything like that happens, you know, what always comes out of it is the togetherness and the spirit of the place. And that was really amazing to see with Manchester. And a couple of things I just wanted to drop in here. So the first thing was, I don't know if you saw this, but coming out of a minute's silence, people started just spontaneously singing Don't Look Back in Anger. So... that was really amazing. Let's have a little bit of that here. The other big one that happened this week was the Cortinas, the band, played Old Trafford, which was just amazing. I didn't realise they had kind of 50,000 fans in the country, let alone in one city, so fair play to them. And yeah, and they also did a version of Don't Look Back in Anger, and that got an amazing response as well, as you might expect. So let's have a little bit of that. And just finally, the other thing I really wanted to play was just a little bit of the poem This Is The Place by Tony Walsh that was read out at the memorial service. And I don't know if, I imagine most people here have seen this, but I'm not going to play the whole thing. I'll just drop a little snippet in. It's nothing to do with Oasis, really, but it is about Manchester. And I just thought it was such a touching tribute. And it's sort of, yeah, it's so touching. Enjoy.
make us a record, a new number one, and make us a brew while you're up, love, go on, and make us feel proud that you're winning the league, and make us sing louder, and make us believe it, that this is the place that has helped shape the world, and that this is a place where a Manchester girl named of Emmeline Pankhurst from the streets of Moss Side. From the streets of Moss Side led a suffragette city with sisterhood pride. And this is the place with appliance of science. We're on it, atomic. We struck with defiance in the face of a challenge. We always stand tall. Mancunians in union delivered it all, such as housing and libraries and health, education and unions and co-ops, the first railway station. So we're sorry. Bear with us. We invented commuters. But we hope you forgive us. We invented computers.
Yeah, so I'm not crying. You're crying. Moving on from that, really. Onto the Oasis stuff. So it was an incredible week, as I said, for Oasis. The Noel Gallagher had his birthday party, which was a big deal. And then he was all over the radio because it was his 50th birthday. So he was on Radio X, and there was a Nothing But Noel Night on Absolute Radio and all that sort of craziness. I'll touch on that with Chris. And then also obviously with Liam. So Liam, a tweet came out sort of saying, expect something big in the morning. And then and some people said, oh, Oasis reunion. No, come on, we know that's not going to happen, or not in that way anyway. And and it was the announcement of these tour dates that were literally happening in a couple of days. And then the fact that this single was going to be played as well. So we heard this snippet, this 30-second snippet, which you heard at the start of the show. And then yesterday, the full version of that was then played for the first time, and it's now, the video's out, and it's now on Spotify and iTunes and all that good stuff, so it's out there. As well as that, obviously he's played these two gigs this week. He played in Manchester at first, and Bonehead came on, which was great to see, and also and he did that incredible live a cappella version of Live Forever, which was quite a powerful thing for him to do at the end of the show. And he played all these new songs as well. So I'm not going to go into that here because we're going to go into it with Chris. But what I did do is I asked out there for people to send in their little quick reviews. And we got a few of those, so let's just drop them in here.
Can see Liam, just come out of the Ritz, feeling very hot and sweaty. What a set that was. Absolutely amazing. Just coming on stage, to fucking in the bushes, straight into Rock and Roll Star, followed by Morning Glory. Some of his new stuff. I think he played about 8-9 songs, maybe. Played a fan favourite, Slide Away, obviously. Bonehead come on to play Be Here Now with them before Liam did a very strange version of Live Forever for the encore with maracas and just him on his vocals. Very strange ending to a gig. Not really experienced anything like that before. But all in all, was a good gig. Great atmosphere. And all the best to him and his new album.
So that was Brandon Clark at Brandon Clark 96. Thank you so much, Brandon, for getting in touch and doing that. Really appreciate it. And this one is from Brandon's dad, Jason.
Hi, just coming out of the Ritz, Manchester. Been to see Liam Gallagher, the return of the king, as it was. Great set, lots of new songs. He played, I would guess it was half and half, half new songs with his band and half Oasis. He came on to Fucking in the Bushes, straight into Rock and Roll Star, Morning Glory. It's obviously got all the crowd up. Then he did play a lot of new stuff for the first time, even the single, which is out this week. And typical Liam, he sort of went off when he'd had enough. And came on and did an acoustic version of Live Forever, which the crowd loved. He's back, and rock and roll needs him. Peace.
So that was Manchester at the Ritz, and then a couple of nights later, it was London's turn at the Brixton Electric, and we had this great message from Scott Mahidi at Hib76.
Hello there, mate. My name's Scott and I'm from Deal in Kent. I've just come back from Liam Gallagher. You wanted to hear from us. Incredible. I was a bit nervous about the voice. I thought I knew the Oasis songs would be amazing, but from what I saw on Periscope from Manchester, I thought the new songs, although they sounded good, I thought a lot of melodies, a lot of high notes, and I was nervous. But I don't know if that wasn't coming across well, but there in person, he sang it perfectly. The singing was unbelievable. It was just classic Liam. Amazing. Don't know what more to say, really. Great atmosphere. He seemed to be loving it. The band were amazing. The song sounded unbelievable. A lot of adjectives. But yeah, just amazing. Just Liam. Brilliant. Cheers, mate.
So yeah, thank you, Scott, so much for doing that. I do really appreciate it. And anyone listening, if you would like to be heard on the podcast, then get in touch, drop me an audio message, just like those guys did. I'd love to hear from you, whether it's thoughts on the new single. Should Noel have invited Liam and his mum Peggy to his birthday party, or was he better off inviting Madonna and Bono? What do you think? Let me know. Drop me an audio message, and if it's interesting or funny or cool, I'll play it. That's all good. Just quickly, I just wanted to say I had a couple more really nice iTunes reviews. So we had from Ben Higgins, What I've Been Waiting For, 5 stars, superb lesson, enjoyed every episode so far, and they keep getting better, man. And we had Wilberforce's Best said, top stuff, lovely, informal and personal look into Oasis, thanks for getting this up and running. And we had Kaluna Lee said, brilliant, love it, keep it up, one day you will get Noel for an episode. Well, we'll see. We haven't got Noel yet, and I don't think I'll necessarily get him anytime soon, but who we have got is coming up is Tony McCarroll, which has just been recorded just the night before I've recorded this. So that was an amazing thing to get Tony. He was a lovely guy. It was a really interesting interview. And thank you so much for everyone who sent your questions. So that's recorded and will be coming up soon. I also have recorded with Paolo Hewitt, which was another really interesting episode, and also the author Nick Ames, which is a great episode as well. So loads of good stuff there, more good stuff to come. Once again, if you can get me in touch with someone who was involved in the Oasis story, or was just a, or not necessarily involved, but has an interesting story to tell, you know, always looking for interesting people to come on the podcast. So yeah, that's all for me for now. I'm going to have a brief musical interlude, and then we'll be hearing from Chris at the stage left. Yes, I know I've been wrong. I didn't do what I was told. Yes, I know you saw some. You didn't do what I was told. Right, back by popular demand, the first ever returning guest on the Oasis podcast. It's Chris from Stage Left. How you doing, man?
Hungover.
Hungover? Okay.
I'm hungover because, yeah, I went to Liam's gig last night and it was a rather magical night. So, yeah, but I'm doing all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, I'm very good. I'm still buzzing because I interviewed Tony McCarroll last night. Which is just...
Oh, nice one. Which was is, that while the gig was on, or did you...
It was actually... It was just before the gig, actually. It was... I spoke to him about 7:30 and then sort of got off the phone, I think, probably just as kind of the live streams were starting. But I didn't really watch that one. I thought... No, I watched the other one live stream, the Manchester one. Yeah. So I thought, no, I won't just sort of spoil it. I'm sure I'll catch them up over the time. But yeah, so well, let's just take a step back, because you were away, weren't you, for the start of this like insane week we've had? You were in Rome.
Yeah, I've been in Italy for 2 weeks. I was in different places: Venice, Rome, Florence. And it was actually I was in Sorrento, driving along the Amalfi Coast when I got the news that it's a very beautiful place to be when you get the news that Liam's going to be doing some gigs. And I had to kind of very hastily kind of find somewhere I could get Wi-Fi to try and get the tickets, which I managed to get somehow, which was great. And yeah, so it's been a busy week with all the new single and stuff as well, which has been and Noel's stuff as well. So there's been a lot going on. You must have been busy.
Well, it's been mad. I mean, that's the thing. It's like it's I wasn't ever expecting this to be a news based podcast, but it's like bloody hell. You know, there's been so much going on this week. So it's this episode that people are listening to now is obviously is a bit of news. We've had these really good clips from people that have sort of sent in and given their little stories, which has been good fun. And then and just catching up on it. So I mean, let's just take it back a step. So first off, we had the little snippet of Wall of Glass released. I mean, did you hear that one, that the first 30 seconds came out, and then the 30 seconds from Facebook?
Yeah, that's it. I saw both of those, and I got to say, I was one of the people who thought we'd heard most of the song then, you know, because like there was a few people online who were saying, oh no, the bit in the studio was just like the bridge and there'll be a chorus afterwards. But I could tell it was kind of just leading straight back to the Wall of Glass line, which it ended up being. But yeah, no, that was exciting, kind of frustrating because you end up just listening to 36 seconds on loop, don't you? And then you start questioning your life and you realise what you're doing. I did listen to that 30 second loop about 80 times, it was nice to hear the real thing when it came out.
Well, the first thing I did, because obviously you've got this prominent harmonica in it, and straight away my mind went, oh, Mark Feltham, I've got the exclusive. And so I dropped Mark a text, and he just came back straight away and said, no, sorry James, not me. And he said, and he said, with that playing as well, I'm pleased it's not, or something like that. And I said, oh, right, okay. Really? So, I mean, I don't know enough about the harmonica to tell you whether or not it's well played. This sounds all right to me, but there you go.
It's played, well, I know that part was played by, Liam said yesterday, that it's played by the producer, I think now, I want to say Gary Kirsten, but I might have got that name wrong. The guy who's produced some of the tracks and written some of the tracks, he wrote
Hello. The guy who wrote for Adele, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so he's playing that part, I believe.
Oh, so that would be, yeah, you can tell if you are, like Mark is, the leading harmonica player in the country, if you're just getting some guy who blows a little bit of harmonica, yeah, that would, that would be annoying.
Well, you never know. I don't know that Gary's credentials, but I think it sounds fine.
It sounds all right. To the untrained ear, you know, to the non-professional harmonica player ear, it sounds all right. But
Gen played a harmonica on a few Oasis tracks, didn't he? I think he played harmonica on Mucky Fingers. It sounds fine.
Sounds all right. Yeah. And then obviously we've had the full version now. So what's your thoughts? Have you heard that about 80 times?
I have. Yeah, I love it. I really do love it.
Good.
Mainly, I love the production of it. It genuinely sounds fresh. I could see it had the fingerprints of a completely different producer and different co-writer all over it, which is good. I think that song could easily have ended up sounding like a BDI song.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. I think like chord structure wise it could have been a BDI song. And I actually think, interestingly, that one thing I would say about the gigs this week is that the live performance of Wall of Glass, I think, does sound a bit BDI-ish. I don't think they quite replicate what's on the record. It doesn't sound that fresh. It sounds like an Oasis-style BDR Liam rock band playing a version of that song.
Yeah. But
I think the production is just, it's really good. Although one thing, actually, I don't know if you've picked up or any of the listeners might have, but if you listen with headphones and turn it up really loud, it clips all the tom parts that that Dan the drummer plays. So
all
it's
right.
Like, I don't know if it's an error or if it's deliberate kind of compression, but like once you hear it, you can't unhear it. So if I'd recommend going and have a listen to that song with headphones and turn it up really loud, and it distorts, which you shouldn't do. It should distort. But that's one thing I picked up on. But it's a good tune. I really like the ooze, the kind of bridge.
Those chants, yeah.
Yeah, and to me that was the bit where I kind of thought, well, that's where the kind of producers come in. All I don't think Liam would have written that part.
No, that's a bit of producer magic, isn't it? That's a bit of pop sheen.
It sounds young and fresh, and it doesn't sound like a 44-year-old who was in Oasis, you know, which is really good. So encouraging, really, really pleased.
What do you think? One of the guys on Twitter, Felix Black, who's from Luxembourg, he sort of has pointed out like that little break it does, where it sort of is quite discordant, like yeah. He's like, oh, that completely ruins the song for me. I don't know. I like it. I think it's like it feels like David Bowie sort of Berlin Trilogy. It's just a bit discordant and a bit weird. I like it.
I like it. I think, Felix, it could be a case that there's not enough new material that's been released, so perhaps we're just listening to it over and over again. And yeah, I think it's the kind of thing you probably wouldn't pick up so much if he'd released his album all at the same time. It's fine. It's just a breakdown before the last chorus. So.
Yeah. And the voice. What do you think of the voice on record?
Well, as always, his voice on record is fantastic. It's never, in my opinion, never been poor on record. I think the BDI stuff and like the Dig Out Your Soul album, his voice is incredible, and Back It Up and other stuff. His voice has only ever really been an issue towards mid to back end of tours where it really deteriorates, and that will be his challenge again this time.
Yeah. So awesome. So cool. And so moving on to the live stuff then. I mean, what was the journey? What was the atmosphere like getting ready and getting in?
It was great. I mean, we had a couple of beers beforehand. I met a guy who we've been to pretty much every Oasis gig together. As I mentioned when I was on before, 12, 15 times, we've probably seen them. And we went for, actually, I think the place was called Ritzy, funny enough, which was just opposite the Brixton venue. We had a couple of beers and, got straight in. No trouble kind of getting in through the queues and stuff. Obviously, security was quite tight, but that was good. That was reassuring. And got in, and Steve and I are a pair of short asses, and we realised it was a totally flat standing area, which is always a bit of an issue. Like if it was been the Brixton Academy, it's cool, because that used to be a cinema, and so you've got the slant. But it wasn't. So there was this kind of upstairs bit that you could stand on this balcony, and we thought, it looked like it was kind of packed, but we managed to get this incredible vantage point where it was kind of just pretty much opposite and pretty much centre stage on with no obstruction, kind of on standing on the edge. We had a little area that you could put your beers down, and even better, we had a speaker right in front of us that was hanging from the ceiling.
Perfect.
So it was completely unobstructed view, and if you want to have a look on Instagram.com/StageLeftPodcast, you'll see I uploaded some videos of being out. Rock and Roll Star and Do You Know What I Mean and Morning Glory. Perfect. And Slide Away, I think, as well. And the sound quality is great, just because we got lucky that there was a speaker there.
Cool. Give us that Instagram, I guess, address again, mate.
Yeah, it's instagram.com/TheStageLeftPodcast. Okay. And if you want to rip into the audio for this and cut in a little bit now, that's cool. But the sound quality was decent, given that it was the context we were recording it in. And what was really interesting, what was incredible was that, so you had Paul Gallagher doing a little set beforehand, and he kind of got everybody in a pretty party mood, and then Liam came on, and when he did the first two songs, which were Rock and Roll Star, Morning Glory, we have a kind of a quote that we have with my group of friends, which is, "It will never be like Wembley 2000," which was when Happy Mondays came on just for Oasis and the Oasis gig at Wembley Stadium, where it was just the most crazy swell of euphoria and kind of moshing, kind of all that kind of stuff. And we were, the only other time I've seen that was actually Heaton Park when Stone Roses did their first gigs back. And honestly, it was exactly the same last night. We weren't down in the pit, but you watch the videos if you can. I can't believe the roof stayed on the place. It was absolute pandemonium. But it was quite a paradoxical gig in that he would then play those kind of songs and it would be absolute euphoria. His voice was great. It was madness. And then he would play a couple of new songs and it was just silence and complete stillness and people just observing and listening, because obviously no one knew the song, so no one really danced to the new songs or anything like that, apart from Wall of Glass a bit. But it was a bit of a crazy gig, because then he would do You Know What I Mean and Slide Away, and then it'd be back to that kind of complete pandemonium.
Bedlam.
It was bedlam, but it was magic.
Cool. And what's your views on that, obviously only having seen them live? Have you rewatched a few of the videos of the
I've seen a couple of them.
The other songs? Have you formulated any opinions yet?
My opinion is that I don't think, having heard the recorded version, I don't think what we hear will be that reflective of what ends up on the record. So obviously it's the same song, and that goes without saying, but I know a lot of people heard Wall of Glass on Tuesday at the Ritz and were kind of a bit disappointed by it. And then they heard the recorded studio version, and the very same people absolutely loved it. So I think one of the challenges is for the band to kind of replicate what's going to be on the record, because it sounds like there's been a lot of production put into it. Mm. There's only so much you can do with two guitars, a few pedals, and a keyboard. The tune sounded okay. I would say they were a little bit underwhelming. It wasn't like we were kind of going, wow, these are absolutely amazing. There was Universal Gleam seemed quite interesting and a bit different. We'll hold judgment until maybe we've got some better recordings. I know he's playing tonight, and it's been streamed live.
Is it?
A festival
it's
in Germany, I think.
Rock am Ring, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's been streamed live, so we might get some better recordings, and then we can kind of make a better judgment. Bold sounds good, by the way. I say the other one. I was going to say Bold did sound really good.
I was going to say that's the one I sort of listened out for, especially because, you know, in one of my first episodes, I'd sort of pulled that Irish pub recording of Bold, and so it's quite nice for that to sort of come back and hear that again. I thought that sounded pretty good.
And that was standard. I think that will be the next single or a single. It was a different level to the other ones we heard there.
Yeah, and I thought that when I first heard Bold in the pub, it was like you could hear this very, very similar to the Master Plan in chord structure, whereas actually hearing it on the stage with the additional sort of instrumentation, I didn't get that as much. It didn't feel like a Master Plan kind of copy. So hopefully that'll, you know, as I say, with we know working with these great producers and with a good band behind him, like, you know, just the difference, as you said, with Wall of Glass. I mean, it will be really interesting to hear what Bold particularly sounds like once we hear it. But
yeah, I reckon that'll be a lead single, because I think I might be wrong, but I heard somewhere that Wall of Glass isn't a lead single in America. It's only over here. So you might, apologies if I've got that wrong, but I think it's not a lead single in America. And I think Bold would suit the American audience very well.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Good, awesome. So that was the night then. And what about the old finishing with Live Forever a cappella? I was a bit confused. I thought it might have been a mistake, like that there'd been like some power outage or something, and that's why he just did it, you know, just a cappella, just with a bit of percussion. But then he did exactly the same thing in Brixton, right?
Yeah, no, it was. I think he's trying to make a point that his vocal cords are sounding really good at the moment, which they are. Bless him. I think Ivory got a bit carried away, but if you see, he's got a percussionist there. This Dan McDougal, and he's doing these. He's got these shakers going, and Liam just did not keep in time with these shakers whatsoever. And I was like, Liam, you're ahead of it. Like, either just don't have him on, or like stick to the shaker. And like, you could see this Dan kind of looking at the back of Liam's head, thinking like, no, yeah, listen to me, listen. I'm trying to shake these in time. That was pretty special. I think it would have been more effective if I hadn't heard about it. You know, so
yeah.
It was kind of coming, kind of expecting it, but that was really a beautiful moment.
Awesome.
But I'll tell you, Slide Away was the one. Slide Away was fucking banging, as was B&L was great. It was a good gig. I mean, I'm still surprised he's playing such a lot of the set with new songs. I think it's like at least six or seven. I wonder if when he's playing these festivals tonight and going on, if he's going to do that. It seems kind of more sense to play a few more Oasis songs, given that the album isn't even out to October.
And he's only playing like, you know, he's only doing like a 12, 13 song set as well, isn't it? Whereas, you know, most big headlining bands these days do sort of a couple of hours or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah. And like, I mean, when he plays his set at Reading, which I think he'll have a slightly longer set because he's one under the headliners, he's going to have to throw in, you know, a few more Oasis tunes. But the band sounded pretty good, and he just sounded on it. And I think it was special also because he mentioned that in an interview after Rick's that he was quite nervous about that gig, and he was kind of, there's a lot of anxiety given everything that had gone on, and he didn't really enjoy it that much. He was just kind of getting through it, and the sound wasn't that great. And you could tell that last night there was something in the air. I think probably the nerves had gone, and he was just like, I can enjoy this now. And you kind of picked up on that, so hopefully that confidence will carry on in other performances, and that his voice carries on to the sound as it did last night.
Yeah, awesome. That's great. No, that's brilliant. Well, thank you very much for the update.
Pleasure.
And what about Noel? I mean, I suppose the main big news is that the album's out, what, November the 9th. I wonder if someone in the record companies is just a little bit cheeky and just says, well, I'll tell you what, why don't we do the Liam and Noel albums on the same day, make it a Battle of Britpop 2?
I thought this a while ago. Yeah, it'd be crazy in a way for them not to do it. It would just be, it would take all over the papers, it would take over all the music press. I think it would be a great thing. Whether I think Liam would be totally up for it, yeah. But I don't know if Noel would want to. But it's interesting what the Reverend the Makers guys said, how different it was and stuff like that. Because I won't say who, although it won't take a genius to work this out. But I spoke to someone who's played on that record, and when I asked him what it was like, his phrase off the record was, "It's just like old blues rock, just kind of another kind of old blues rock thing." Which, given some of the stuff we've heard other people talk about it, it's really experimental or it's really different and out there, it's kind of surprising. But so I hope it's not old blues, because you know we've been there and done that, so yeah. Hopefully it'll be a bit more different. But I've confirmed today I'm going to be going to Rome to see Noel support you two, and that's why I'm going to be interviewing Russ Pritchard, Noel's bassist, for another episode of Stage Left. That confirmed this afternoon, well, about 2 hours ago. Got an email from Russ, so that's going ahead. So maybe Noel might play a couple of songs on at those gigs that are new off that album. And if he does, I'm happy to kind of appear again and let you know, we'll give you the lowdown.
Awesome, good. And did you get your invite to Noel's 50th?
No, I think I got lost in the post. Actually, it might have been while I was in Italy.
That's why. Yeah, I boycotted it because I didn't want to hang around with Bono and Madonna. So sorry, Noel. I keep it real, mate.
But listen, I think a lot can be read into the fact that, you know, why does Noel want to reform Oasis when he's kind of gone himself? He was a guy, you know, from Burnage, 23 years ago, who imagine you said to him, "Oh, like Madonna and Bono can be coming to your 50th birthday party." Do you know what I mean? Like, whether you like that or not, given, you know, I'm fine with it, but whether people like it or not, like, you can, things are going well for him, and that to me just cements even more a reason why would he go and now be stage left to Liam and just play guitar solos for an hour and a half playing old, you know, he's, what's in it for him? Nothing really. He's centre stage now, and he's his life is pretty good by the sounds of things. So, but no, I didn't get the invite, but it sounded like it was a pretty awesome party to have gone to.
Yeah. Cool. All right, mate. Well, I'll tell you what, thank you so much for your time again. Well done for being the first returning guest on the podcast. And
it's a pleasure. And I look forward to appearing again.
No, it's fine. It's all good. It's all good fun. Good stuff to come. So, and we look forward to, and just to let people know that by the time this is out, the Guns N' Roses, just tell us briefly about that.
Yes, I launched that this morning, so it's actually out now. So, Guns N' Roses guitarist Richard Fortus giving a proper exclusive interview. Actually, some of the stuff he says on it about them recording and writing new material at the moment isn't anywhere else on the entire planet. So I got a feeling it might blow up a little bit. So, that's an hour and a half of us talking about working with Slash, the writing process behind Chinese Democracy, because he got a songwriting credit on it, working with Axl Rose, what makes Axl Rose unique, and his life and the music industry. So, that's been released. I started it all this morning. So, so hopefully that will get the podcast to a new audience, and it's got some interesting stuff on there.
Awesome. Great. Well, everyone, if you're not subscribed, get over and subscribe to The Stage Left and give the man Chris a 5-star review and on iTunes as well. So, awesome. Chris, thank you so much for your time, mate, and we will speak again soon.
Cheers, man. Keep up the good work.
Awesome. Thanks. So this epic episode of the Oasis podcast continues. We're now on to the main event, which is the interview with Vivek Tiwari, who we'll get into it in the conversation. But he is a author and a renaissance man, really. He's done all kinds of stuff, but we have a very interesting conversation mainly around the graphic novel The Fifth Beatle, which is a fantastic piece of work, which I wax lyrical about in quite embarrassing detail in the interview to come. So I hope you enjoy that. There is a bit of Oasis chat, talking about Vivek, seeing them in the 90s in America and doing a bit of work for Sony at the time as well. So yeah, so there is some Oasis chat, but not a huge amount. But there you go. Anyway, so now on to me with Vivek Tiwari. You say yes, I say no. You say stop, and I say go, go, go. Oh no, you say goodbye. Good. Well, thank you very much for your time. I do really appreciate it.
Thanks for wanting to have me on.
No, that's it's absolutely my pleasure. It's great. It's one of those really fortuitous ones where I read The Fifth Beatle. So I'm in the kind of the sort of the perfect storm, really, of being a huge Beatles fan and a huge comic fan. And so it was just in the absolutely perfect for me when Fifth Beatle came out, because you think, wow, this is right up my street. You've captured my favorite band, and in what I think is the perfect format. So so I've looked out, you know, I love The Fifth Beatle, and I just want first off just to congratulate you on what an absolutely incredible piece of work that is.
Oh, thank you so much. I am very, very proud of it, and it is a long time labor of love. I've been researching Brian's life ever since I was in college, so, you know, over two decades now. So it really is a joy to have it released and to have folks like you say that they've read it and enjoyed it. So thank you for saying that.
No, you're more than welcome. And then the interesting thing was, because as I say, I told you on the Something About the Beatles podcast, which was really interesting and gave a bit more of a background into the creating of the book itself. And that was great. I mean, I that's one of my favorite podcasts, and that was a really interesting episode. Did you enjoy that, speaking to those guys?
I did enjoy that. I know those guys very well. We, you know, I've spent a lot of time on the Beatles festival circuit.
Ah, good.
And those guys make a lot of appearances on that circuit as well. So we've got a chance to get to know each other and become friends over the years. So it was really fun to be on that podcast as well.
Oh, great. So yeah, I mean, I think I just saw you on Twitter. I was, you know, because I'm an evangelist for the book, and so I will, if ever anyone's,
thank you.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you're desperate for people to see, and I've heard you mention on another podcast before as well that there is this stigma still, which is absolutely ridiculous, about sequential art, about the graphic novel or the comic format, which is madness.
Yeah.
Because what's the most successful TV show? It's The Walking Dead. You know, what's the biggest film franchise? It's the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All these things are based on comics, and yet still there is this stigma with a certain percentage of the population. And, you know, and something like The Fifth Beatle is absolutely perfect, because you can put it in front of a Beatles fan who would say, oh, I don't read comics. You say, well, would you read a book about Brian Epstein? Oh, absolutely. Well, read this. And I haven't had anyone who's come back and sort of said, oh, well, you know, oh, it was a comic. Anyone that reads it, I think, just completely buys into it. And it is almost like a gateway drug into comics, I think, because you think, we'll try
this. I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah, you know, it brings me a great, you know, I too am a huge Beatles fan and a huge comics fan. So, it brings me a great deal of pleasure when I have other Beatles fans come up to me and say, you know, this was the first graphic novel I've ever read, and, you know, I picked it up because I'm a Beatles fan and not because of comics, and that they say they've gotten turned on to the medium, and what else should we read? And similarly, you know, there's a lot of Beatles fans out there, so this doesn't happen often, but once in a while, I'll get somebody who's come up to me who's a huge comics fan and says, you know, I'm not really a huge Beatles fan, and, you know, but I heard a lot about this book, and it sounded interesting, and you really turned me on to the Beatles. And, you know, so those two things in particular are really exciting to me. You know, if I could turn on and usually the latter is a kid, you know, really somebody who's very young who didn't grow up with the Beatles. in the same way that, that you and I may have.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I can help to turn the younger generation on to someone like the Beatles, and certainly if I can expose Beatles fans to comics, you know, then I feel like I've done some good work.
No, it's brilliant. It's great. And I mean, just today, it's funny. I was in London today. I live just outside. I live sort of about 40 miles outside London, but I do travel into London quite a bit. And there was a guy on the underground today reading Saga.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of those things that I didn't do it, actually. I wish I'd, because the guy had headphones, I didn't want to bother him. But, you know, and on the London Underground, we don't talk to each other, you know. Because still there is that stigma. I probably wouldn't sit and read Saga on the Underground. You know, I just think that people would be looking at you with that thought. So if I see someone openly reading like a Saga even if it's Watchmen or something like that, you just want to go up to them and say, well done. Yes, it's great,
right.
Isn't it? You know, well done,
right.
You. So.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, and maybe it's just because I try to be as much an optimist in life, is I do feel like that's changing. You know, I think that we have made great strides. You know, you pointed out The Walking Dead and all the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I think as a result of those things, slowly people are coming around. You know, you're absolutely right. The stigma's not gone. But it's certainly far less there than it was, you know, even 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, I think you're more likely to see somebody on the subway reading Saga now than you were 5 years ago. So, and
yeah,
that's a beautiful thing.
No, it's great. It's great. And, so, I mean, taking it back, I was just going to say, you know, your background, really. So, because I've heard you on a few podcasts talking about the Fifth Beatle and things, but I never really dug back into your history. So what about you? I know you grew up in New York City, is that right?
I did indeed. Yeah, I was actually born here. My family's originally from India. My parents were actually born in Guyana, South America, but I was born here in New York. And there's no question that I got my love of music and the arts jointly from my parents and from my city. You know, my parents didn't work in the arts. My dad was a doctor and my mom was an attorney, more traditional fields for Indian people.
Indian and, family, absolutely, yeah.
They love the arts. Yeah, I mean, you know, a big part of the Brian Epstein story is that Brian inspired me to chase my dreams at a time when, you know, I was expected to become a doctor or an engineer like many of my Indian peers. You know, that's just what Indians do, and those are the kind of fields my family and my parents were involved in. You know, and but they loved the arts, even though they didn't work in the arts. And so ever since I was a little kid growing up in New York, I grew up on 12th Street, they would take me uptown to Times Square to see Broadway shows, and a little further uptown to Lincoln Center to see opera and ballet. And they would take me to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Museum of Modern Art. And, you know, so I was exposed to all the fine arts, if you will.
Wow.
And then as soon as I was allowed out of the house on my own, I was going downtown to see punk rock shows at the old CBGBs and the old Ritz.
Oh, great.
And experimental theater performances at the Worcester Group and at La Mama. And so, you know, I really grew up as a result of having the parents that I had and as a result of living in this wonderful city. I grew up just being exposed to all the formats of the arts, from the fine arts to the experimental arts, and just really loving it all.
That's amazing.
And as, you know, a connective tissue to you, my friend, my parents grew up in Guyana when it was a British colony. It did go independent in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a British colony for a good chunk of their life. And as a result of that, my mother left Guyana and moved to London. And they basically spent the equivalent of college and law school at London. She qualified as a barrister at the Inns of Court at Gray's Inn in London.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all very relevant because for my mother, London was without question a second home. And for me, growing up, it might be a bit of a stretch to call it quite a second home, but it was pretty darn close. I mean, we were there often, and my mother really had an affinity for the place. And both of my parents loved the Beatles, so there's no question that I got my love of the Beatles, of Britpop, of all things British, from my folks and from spending a lot of my early years in London. You know,
wonderful.
So the cities that I grew up in, you know, New York and London to a lesser degree, really are a huge part in what gave me my passion for music and the arts.
No, great. And what was it? You know, I mean, you talk about then. going to the old CBGB, sorry, get that right. And I mean, I suppose with, you know, if you're, I think you're about 7 years older than me. So what are we talking, early 90s?
Yeah, that's about right. And that's about right. You know, I was born in 1973.
Yeah.
Was when I was born. So even the late 80s, you know, when I was a teenager.
Okay.
You know, I had started to go see punk rock shows, and so I kind of came out of the tail end of the punk rock scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Ramones had already kind of made their big splash, so I was sort of in the post-punk moment when I was going
mm-hmm.
to places like CBGBs, like seeing early Sonic Youth concerts and that sort of thing.
Oh wow!
You know, the first time I saw Oasis, you know, getting over to Oasis was at the CBGBs of Philadelphia. It was at a very small club called J.C. Dobbs. Which doesn't exist anymore, but literally there had to have been less than 100 people in the audience.
Oh, wow. What, so when was this? When was this, Vivek?
You know, that would have been, you know, I'm going to guess 1993. You know, definitely maybe had just come out
okay.
in the States and, you know, was sort of gaining traction here. It was not a big record yet here. You know, so the people, you know, the club wasn't even sold out. And most of the kids that were there were kids like me who... you know, who because of their personal interests were sort of, you know, following what was going on across the pond. I don't think
sure.
that Oasis at the time even had a ton of just purely American fans who discovered them because they were music fans as opposed to being American, you know, Britpop fans, if that
yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. And tell me about that. So you, this must have been the, I think if that's just when Definitely Maybe came out, that must have been the first American tour then. And I'm sure one of our listeners will jump in and give us
yeah.
the exact date and the exact set list and things like that.
Yeah,
sure that's the thing. I started this.
Isn't that funny?
Exactly. But I started this podcast just because I, you know, wanted an Oasis podcast. No one else was doing it. But actually, my knowledge of Oasis is okay. It's pretty good. But then I'm nowhere near half as much as some of the listeners. I've had people pulling me up and say, excuse me, you mentioned that this came out in this state. It was actually initially released. I think, okay, I'm trying my best,
yeah,
man.
I
Come
mean,
on.
I'm guessing it was 93. I mean, that, I think that was when Definitely Maybe.
Definitely Maybe was 94. So I'm probably 94. But hey.
So,
we're,
maybe it was 94 then.
Yeah.
So I started college in 1991, and it had to have been about halfway through my stint there. So maybe it was 94.
Yeah, yeah. But what did you think? I mean, how did they compare to the other bands that you were seeing at the time?
So, you know, I will be totally frank. I thought they were really good. You know, I was not blown away by Oasis until Morning Glory.
Right.
You know, so Definitely Maybe came out. I was working for Sony Music. I was a college marketing representative. So I was a kid in college who was working for Sony, and I was responsible for marketing all the Sony Music distribution albums, so primarily Epic Records and Columbia Records, to the college circles. And what that meant was college radio, independent
mm-hmm.
record stores, you know, the CD stores on campuses that catered to the college community, providing tour support when bands were coming through the college market, and marketing the records in what are called lifestyle accounts, which means like the coffee shops and the skate shops and the tattoo parlors and any of the kind of, you know, non-music stores that the college kids were hanging out at. College kids like myself, I say kids, it sounds a little condescending. I was one of them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered, you know, shortly, as was always the case, you know, shortly before a record actually hit street date, you know, they would send us a box of new CDs. So, you know, we would get the records first so we could give it to the radio stations and help to generate some early buzz. And I remember getting a copy of Definitely Maybe and being a fan of as I said, all things British. I was kind of aware of Oasis, you know, because they had already been you know, quite buzzing over in the UK. And there was another one of my college reps, one of my counterparts in the San Francisco area, who was a massive fan. And
oh, yeah.
So he had, you know, was talking up this record as, you know, as though it was really the next big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember listening to it and thinking that it was really solid and you know, and being really impressed with like the wall of sound and Supersonic, and you know, really thinking that there was something there. I need to be myself. I can't be no one else. I'm feeling supersonic. Give me gin and tonic. You can have it all, but how much do you want it? Make me laugh. Your autograph. massively blown away. I'll be totally frank. You know, mm-hmm. I've been a huge fan of the Stone Roses. Stone Roses are probably, you know, still one of my top 10 bands of all time. And, you know, to me, when I listened to Definitely Maybe, I was like, yeah, it's not as good as the first Stone Roses record, but I think it's pretty great.
Yeah.
You know, just being totally honest, I hope hope your audience won't hate me for saying that.
No.
But I definitely thought the band were great, and I was really excited to see them, and really, you know, excited that I got to work with them in the College Market in those early days. And that show was amazing. You know, and I remembered having a similar experience when, you know, shortly before Morning Glory was out, getting a copy of that from the record label and hearing, you know, even before the full album was done, they played us Wonderwall and Don't Look Back in Anger, and thinking like, oh my gosh, to me at least, that felt like a massive leap forward. And
then
when I got the record, you know, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and I will say, I think What's the Story, Morning Glory, you know, is as good as any of the great Beatles albums.
Wow.
You know, to me, that record was just, I mean, it totally blew my mind. But the first time I saw the band was on that, and it definitely was their first, well, I shouldn't say definitely, maybe one of your audience members will say, actually, there was a U.S. tour before that tour. But my memory is that it was their first U.S. tour. And certainly, my memory is that they had either never been to Philadelphia or certainly, you know, felt like they had never been to Philly. And it was kind of one of these funny memories that I have is I remember the band not really, being totally honest, not really being nice to anyone at Sony except me.
Oh, you know, really?
I was the college kid, you know, who was being, you know, I mean, we got like a, I can't even remember what they paid us, you know, some sort of like honorarium of like $50 a month, but we were essentially, the college reps were doing it for free.
Sure.
For experience. We were almost like glorified interns, but we were paid. But the point is, we were young, we were fans who were working for the company because we loved the music. And I remember they were, you know, hearing that they were, you know, badasses, and they were, you know, they had a reputation of not being particularly nice to the business folks. And I sort of saw that with everybody else, but it was almost like there was a knowing wink with me that they were like, well, you're just a fan and a kid, so we like you.
I think that's definitely what comes across, you know, from the outside, is that anyone in suits or anyone that's sort of telling them what to do, you know, they just couldn't be bothered to play the game. You know, you see, you know, you kind of see that the band's doing these radio, you know, these rounds and rounds and rounds of interviews and things. And, you know, and a lot of them, you know, your Coldplays and people like that will just grin, put on a fake grin and just get through it and do them over and over again. Whereas the likes of Oasis, they're not going to do that. They're not going to be asked to go and speak to, like, you know, Phil and Crazy Keith on the morning show and all that
sort of stuff. Yeah,
right. You know.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, the band, they were all, again, this, you know, my memory, this is a long time ago, but my memory is that they were already pretty massive in the UK, and, you know, here they are in the US, where at the time, you know, they were still relatively unknown and playing like a tiny club that was not even sold out. And, you know, superficially, like on the front, you know, what they projected was, you know, we're annoyed to be playing this small club, like, you know, where are our audiences, not being terribly, you know, in love with the small US audience that was there. You know, I know that they went on to occasionally, I think it was either that tour or following tour, they had some rude shout outs to the American audiences. I didn't see any of that, but there was a little bit of that attitude there.
Yeah.
But then kind of when the show was over and there was like the backstage stuff, like, to me, they radiated a like, oh, you're right, mate. You know, like, you know, you like the record, like almost like they were pleased to see that like the real fans were coming out and wanting to learn more about the band. But they still projected this sort of sense to the record label suits and to be fair to the audience that was not sort of let behind the curtain, if you will.
Yeah.
Of you know, we couldn't be bothered and we're massive elsewhere, so you know, you guys need to catch on.
Yeah.
But with me they were actually quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I have only the coolest memories of that. And you know, to be able to sit here years later and you know, see what they became, and then hear those records that followed, that to me showed huge improvements.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to say, wow, I saw Oasis at J.C. Dobbs, and it wasn't even sold out. It's, you know, it's like It's one of those, like, I was there, man. That's
I was there
cool.
when. Like, you the know, Sex Pistols, like, in Manchester, that every, you know, they say that, you know, that there was 30 people there. And yet, if you ask, you know, probably like 10,000 people in Manchester say that they were there.
Yeah. Well, I was actually at the JC Dobster. I really was. You know, there it's one of these moments where I'm like, you know, I may be an old dude now, but I did see some great bands at some great places, including that one, you know?
That is cool.
But man, it's true. When I remember when I heard What's the Story, Morning Glory for the first time, it really, like, it was like a slap in the face.
Yeah.
I mean, I hadn't heard a record that good from a band that felt to me like a new band, and I couldn't even remember when. You know, maybe since I heard that first Stone Roses record.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like, people, the cool answer is to say that Definitely Maybe is the best record, but What's the Story, Morning Glory is such an incredible achievement. And it's an obvious thing to say, but I don't think it's sort of accepted that, yeah, it's a great album, but hold on, you know, no, let's just think about this. This is up there with, you know, Radiohead, The Bends, and OK Computer and the Beatles' work. You know, this is a phenomenal piece of work from start to finish. Just the construction of the album, you know, every song has, you know, elements to it. Liam's voice is at its best, and Liam's voice is just incredible throughout on that record. And yeah, and, so it's really nice to hear. And what's interesting is that
I don't dislike Definitely Maybe. You know, to me that was the record that sort of, like, was the gateway drug. Maybe
mm-hmm.
you know, it got me into it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was something really there, but you know, unlike my colleague in San Francisco, you know, I didn't go nuts for Definitely Maybe the way
sure.
that, to be fair, that I did for that first Stone Roses record,
mm-hmm.
you know, or from, but Morning Glory was the one that I could really hold myself out as a hardcore fan over.
Great. And then, so did you carry on working for Sony beyond that that sort of Definitely Maybe tour?
Yeah, so I left Sony sort of halfway through 1996, and then I started working for Mercury Records. And so I did work a little bit in the setup of Be Here Now, and I was certainly involved in the massive anticipation that everybody at the record label and elsewhere felt surrounding that record. But I was not there, you know, for the run of it, shall we say.
Okay.
But I was definitely there, you know, for its setup and for a good chunk of it. Again, if I'm remembering my dates correctly, I think that record came out in 96.
97, Be Here Now.
97, yeah. So I was just there, again, just there for the setup. But it was definitely, you know, I remember getting that record also. So I was there for the beginning of it, I guess.
Sure. And so you were, I mean, it's interesting that I don't think it's, unless people are big sort of music geeks, they probably wouldn't know what the college circuit really means. But, I mean, that was a massive and huge thing. I don't know if it still is in the modern day now, whether it still is the same thing with the internet and with Spotify and everything, but yeah, I remember hearing about, you know, oh well, it's a hit on college radio, and that was such an important thing, which is just weird for, you know, the university system we've got over here. That just makes no sense, but
yeah, no, it is a very interesting thing, and I remember hearing exactly what you're saying, that over in the UK, you know, the uni system didn't have that sort of you know, massive importance to making and breaking a record the way that it did in the U.S. In the years that I was working there. I mean, this is why you know, my role as a college marketing rep was so important, is because, you know, back then in the 90s in the U.S., all the, you know, the great, you know, quote unquote alternative bands, you know, Pearl Jam, Rage Against the Machine, Nirvana, you know, all those groups came out of college radio. I mean,
yeah.
It was the college market that broke those bands first. I mean, subsequently, mainstream radio, you know, picked up on it, and you started to get, you know, alternative radio stations and whatnot. But, you know, it was college radio that embraced those bands first. You know, it's not a surprise that that Definitely Maybe was a huge priority for the college department, because, you know, in the United States, that's where that record was going to be embraced first you know, in 1993, 1994, you know, it was the college market that was going to play that and going to play the crap out of it. You know, it wasn't going to be mainstream radio at first. You know, when it blew up at college, then everybody else would pick it up. But the college market in the early 90s in the United States was the place, you know, to break, you know, the bands that have gone on to be slapped with the label alternative.
Yeah.
You know, but alternative in the early 90s meant the bands that the college kids were listening to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like REM, right? So REM
absolutely.
Is, you know,
absolutely.
And they wrote about it, you know, with Radio Song and things. So they were huge.
Absolutely.
You know, you wouldn't call them alternative in the way, you know, because they'd actually, now you look back and REM are, well, I think that was a strange thing, wasn't it? Because alternative was literally that alternative. But then both in the US with the likes of Nirvana and REM, and in the UK over here with the Britpop, you know, and what we would call indie, suddenly that becomes the mainstream.
Makes me sad. I tried to turn it off, to say goodbye, my love. That radio song.
Hey, hey, hey.
You know, thanks to Oasis,
yeah,
and Blur,
exactly,
and
right.
Pulp having this huge breakthrough. And it's what's quite funny is sort of getting involved on the Twitter, you're getting a lot of people doing sort of, this is the 20th anniversary of this being released and things. And,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And it's crazy that there was these points in 1995 when it was, you know, Supergrass's debut album and Paul Weller's Stanley Road came out on the same day. You think, oh my God, if one album of that level comes out this year, it's a good year.
Yeah.
You know, whereas
yeah.
they were,
yeah,
they,
yeah, yeah.
there was that point in that, kind of between 94 and 96, and obviously, you know, that was when I was 14 to 16, so it's obviously going to be special to me, but I don't think it is just nostalgia. I think it is generally accepted that, you know, no, actually this period of time for British music was firing on all cylinders, and it was the indie bands that previously would have been at number 31 in the charts, and you know, that are suddenly now number one in the charts. It was just a huge turnaround.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was it really was, as you said, the bands that ended up being called alternative were at one point by definition the alternatives. They were there was pop radio. And if you wanted an alternative to pop radio, you listen to college radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's the way it was in the United States. I mean, I remember working, you know, British groups like Skunk Anansie. Don't even remember, you know. And college radio gave Skunk Anansie a chance, you know. Like, they had a little moment at college radio. They unfortunately never broke out beyond that in the United States. But, you know, mainstream radio in the early 90s would never have touched a Skunk Anansie.
No. No, yeah. No, they were big here. I mean, Skunk Anansie, Week, and they had various hits there. They were a big concern here for a few years. Absolutely, Skin was such an incredible kind of front person that you just
totally.
You couldn't ignore them. But no, great. Well, that's really interesting to hear. So sort of, you know, taking it forward in your sort of world then. So moving on from Sony, and then, you know, you've gone into just. I mean, you said that it was around that time at college that you really focused in on Brian Epstein's life, and that was really when you started to germinating ideas of to do something around Brian.
Yeah, so you know, I was at business school. I was at the Wharton School of Business in Philadelphia, and I was working part-time for Sony Music, as we were discussing, and that's how I got exposed to Oasis. And so I was doing everything I could to get into the music industry. I mean, I dreamed of a life in the arts, and in particular a life in music. And the reality is, in the 90s, the Wharton School didn't really have resources for business students who wanted to get involved in the arts. They do now. You know, I go back to the school quite often and guest lecture, and I hope that I'm one of those resources. But in the 90s, they just didn't. You know, the business students then were all pursuing careers in investment banking or finance and accounting and traditional Wall Street jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was even before the internet boom. So they weren't even encouraging business students to get involved in media, much less in the arts.
Mm.
And so I found that I kind of had to do my sort of business studies, if you will, my studies of the arts and entertainment side of business on my own.
Mm.
And I tend to be a pretty academic and a geeky, nerdy guy. And being that sort of lifelong Beatles fan, I thought, okay, if I want to work in the music business, and one of the things I really wanted to do is manage bands, I thought I should study the lives of the great arts managers. I'm not getting this education in my classes, so I'll have to get it on my own.
Absolutely.
So I thought I should study the life of Brian Epstein. You know, I knew that he had gotten the Beatles a record deal after everyone had passed on them. You know, I knew just from being a fan of British music and of Britpop I knew that, you know, when the Beatles came over to the United States and played for Ed Sullivan, that a British band at that time had never made an impact in the United States. I know that the Beatles were kind of the first to kind of lead the British invasion. So I asked myself, like, how did that happen? Like, how did the manager actually help to make that happen? You know, having worked in the music industry a little bit, I appreciated that these things don't just happen. There's usually some sort of a team behind it.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to know, how did that happen? So that's what led me to a study of Brian Epstein. And, you know, I was absolutely rewarded with the Beatles business stories that I was chasing, you know, how he did get that record deal and how he did convince Ed Sullivan to book the band and how he came up with the suits and the haircuts and how he managed the crazy tours in the Philippines and how he convinced the record label to be okay with the crazy instrumentation on Sgt. Pepper's, and, you know, how all that stuff happened. Those were the stories I was chasing as a young business student. And I got those stories and they were fascinating and inspiring. But it's when I uncovered the stories about his personal life and I discovered that he was gay at a period where it was literally against the law.
Yep, absolutely.
He was Jewish at a time of pervasive anti-Semitism. You know, it was far, far worse than it is today. And he was from Liverpool. And Liverpool in 1961, you know, as you and your colleagues across the pond will know better than I, in 1961, you know, Liverpool had and still has, you know, two very important football clubs.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, it doesn't really have any cultural influence in 1961.
No.
I mean, I think if you told someone in 1961 that several decades later it would be voted, you know, capital of culture, they would have laughed at you, you know? But and so here you have in Brian Epstein, a gay 26-year-old Jewish kid running around Liverpool, of all places, in 1961, saying, I found a rock and roll band who are going to be bigger than Elvis, and
absolutely,
who are going to elevate pop music into an art form.
Yeah.
I mean, it was crazy. You
know, it's,
I mean,
incredible.
If you think the Gallagher brothers were crazy to say that, like, you know, the Oasis are bigger than the Beatles, I mean, imagine how Brian Epstein sounded in 1961 when he said the Beatles are going to be bigger than Elvis.
That, I mean, I love the fact that the book keeps coming back to that point as well. He's just saying it to people, but they're going to be bigger than Elvis, and he just keeps, it's like that's his mantra, you know, he sticks to that, and yeah, and yet you've all these people just throwing it back in his face, no Brian, come on, you do this, and there's a lovely page, I haven't got the book in front of me, but there's a lovely page where there's, you know, what is works so well in comics, and you can't, you can kind of maybe do it in cinema, but it just doesn't work the same, where you've got the three, it does the same thing three times, the repetition of the form of the page, and it's three different sets of people just saying no you, well, why don't you try this and think, oh, that's so, you know, that to me, you just go, that's comics, right? That's comics, that
totally.
Nothing, you know, no, nothing else can do that to present an idea in that way, you know, that's Alan Moore level work, you know,
well, thank you for saying that, but that is why I love comics, no question. But, you know, it was this human side of Brian's story, you know, when I learned this, that, you know, you can probably imagine, you know, how that felt to a young Indian kid running around New York's Lower East Side, you know, a brown kid, you know, obsessed with Britpop, who wanted to write comic books and produce Broadway musicals, you know, like, you know, that's crazy, you know, I'm supposed to become a doctor or an engineer.
Yeah.
Like, that's what young Indian kids who have some opportunity are supposed to do with their lives.
Yeah.
You know, but I felt like, man, if the gay Jewish kid from Liverpool could bring the world the Beatles, then, you know, why couldn't the weirdo, you know, Britpop obsessed Indian kid write a comic book, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, you know?
This was quite a new world, really, for me. I was amazed by this sort of dark, smoky, dank atmosphere, this beat music playing away. And the Beatles were then just four lads on that rather dimly lit stage, somewhat ill-clad, and the presentation was, well, left a little to be desired as far as I was concerned, because I've been interested in the theatre and acting for a long time. But amongst all that, something tremendous came over. And I was immediately struck by their music, their beat, and their sense of humour, actually, on stage. And even afterwards, when I met them, I was struck again by their personal charm. And it was there that really it all started.
But anyway, Brian had this shop and, you know, it was good. We used to get pick up the records and he had this big Zephyr Zodiac and he wanted to manage us and we weren't going anywhere anyway. So, you know, he said, yes, might as well. Straight away he got us some jobs, got us a bit more money and then started getting us radio shows and things like that. And then, you know, as we go ahead, we got into our suits. You know, he talked us out of the leather suits.
It was a bit sort of old hat anyway, all wearing leather gear. And we decided we didn't want to look sort of ridiculous just going on because it, more often than not, sort of people, too many people would laugh. It was just stupid. We didn't want to sort of appear as a gang of idiots. And Brian suggested that we just sort of wore ordinary suits.
It was later put around that I betrayed our heavy leather image that we had at the time and I wanted us to get suits. But I seem to recall that we all went quite happily. I didn't have to drag anyone there to the tailors. They all went quite happily.
So, you know, we gladly switched into suits, you know, if we were going to get some more money, get some more gigs.
Brian was a beautiful guy, Brian Epstein, and he was an intuitive, theatrical guy, and he knew we had something, and he presented us well.
And it's so cool that you felt that connection to him and that, you know, it's because it is just such a fascinating story. And one of the moments that I love in the book, and it's something that, you know, obviously there's not video footage, there's not audio footage of every single interaction. And so there's I haven't got the book in front of me, but there's one of my favorite moments is when you have this imagined scene of the famous holiday that John and Brian went on together.
Yeah.
And, you know, and John turns to Brian and says, you'll have to fill in the line for me. But he says something like, okay, well, do you want to do it with me then, Brian, or something? And he sort of, you know, the panel, he just looks up like he's, and then he goes, oh, shame I'm not queer then, isn't it? And then it just pulls out.
And
you just
think,
oh,
looking at guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just think, oh, that's it. He's saying, oh, do you like him then? Do you like him then? And it's just
what about me? Do you find me attractive?
Yeah.
And Brian, you know, has an honest but vulnerable moment where he says, yes. You know,
yeah.
He admits that he does find John attractive, and then John just sort of deadpans, you know, well, it's too bad I'm not queer.
Oh, it's so good. You know, that you just sort of that. Yeah, that was just like a just linger on that for a minute. Let's just enjoy that moment in the book because that is just so powerful. And I mean, I know that the other one I wanted to come on to as well before I forget because it's just the images just keep, you know, it's one of those books that I'll go back to and just images, certain images come back through to me. And like the scene with where Brian meets Colonel Tom Parker.
Yeah.
Because the, you know, pretty much there's flights of fancy in the book and there's sort of it's not, you know, 100% realistic. There's line, you know, there's sort of, there are elements of more fantastical elements and things like montages and collages and different things. But the way that Tom Parker is portrayed is more, you might pick me up on this, but suddenly you get into this, Tom Parker is just this demonic figure. You know, literally a demonic figure.
Yeah.
And you think, well, hold on, this is, you know, no one else has been portrayed in that over the top way. And it's, so you just get this such a powerful, you know, that's such a powerful moment because it's like magic realism, you know, in the, Marquez, where you'll get, you know, you'll just be in a normal situation and then, you know, Remedios the Beauty. Yeah, I don't know if you know 100 Years of Solitude. It's my favorite
absolutely.
Book. And, you know, and it'll just be in a normal situation and then, you know, an 8-year-old girl just ascends to heaven because she's too beautiful for this world. And you just go, what?
I love the Spanish magic realism.
Yeah, and that to me was like a moment at that level because the rest of the book hasn't had that sort of over-the-top elements. And then suddenly you've got this demonic figure of Tom Parker. I mean, was that your choice or was that did the artist come and bring that to you?
No. And that was, I mean, we, you know, as with everything in the book, we kind of worked on it together, but those were definitely my sort of direction and my choices as a writer. And it was very much in the script that over the course of that scene, you know, I wanted Parker to become increasingly more demonic, as you put it, and really vampiric, you know, is the word that I used in the script. Like, I believe that in a sort of poetic way, Colonel Parker really kind of sucked the lifeblood out of Elvis.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I was like, you know, if he sucked the blood out of Elvis, well, like, we should literally portray him as a bloodsucker, you know, as a vampire.
Mm.
You know, and for those comic fans in the audience, you know, you might get a kick out of knowing that literally in the script, what I suggested to Andrew Robinson, the artist, was that he be inspired by 30 Days of Night. You know, I said, make Colonel Parker look like a Ben Temple Smith vampire by the time the scene is over. You know, and I actually wound up having the good fortune of meeting Ben at a comic convention, you know, many, many months after Fifth Beetle had came out, and, you know, he was with me and Andrew, and he said what a fan he was of the book. And so I was like, well, that scene was partially influenced by your art, you know, so it was kind of cool to sort of bring it all full circle. But we very consciously wanted in that moment for Parker to become more like a satanic vampire kind of figure. And, you know, in many ways, the book is really, you know, an exploration of the world and of the Beatles story kind of through Brian's eyes, you know.
Yes.
And I think that's how Brian saw Colonel Parker. You know, you're supposed to be getting a look and feel of what did this look like and feel like to Brian.
Yeah.
And I think that's how Parker felt to him.
No, absolutely. No, it's great. And then just on the... I just want to say what's happening with it, really, because I've been following there was talk of a film and then there was talk of a TV adaptation. I've got the film director Matt Whitecross coming on in the next few days, and I didn't even know this, but I heard in an interview him saying, oh, my next project is maybe a Brian Epstein thing. So is that, I mean, I can cut this out if this is sort of behind the scenes of, is that competing projects,
you know,
or is that combined?
No, so my project is not the one with Matt, and I'm aware that there are a few people who've been trying to get Brian Epstein projects off the ground. So I can't speak to that one, but I can say that we are developing the Fifth Beatle as a 6-part television miniseries.
Okay.
The very exciting piece of news is that we have secured access to Beatles music. So Paul, Ringo, Yoko Ono, and Olivia Harrison have all approved our script and signed off on the project, and we've done a deal with Sony ATV, who controls the music publishing, which is a very long-winded way of saying we have unprecedented access to the Beatles music catalog.
Wow.
For our show. To my knowledge, we are definitely the first, and to my knowledge, we are the only Brian Epstein project or any project about the band's history to have secured complete access to their music.
That's
so very,
huge.
Very excited about
That's
that.
Absolutely huge, isn't it? I mean, I remember, I don't know if you saw the Jimi Hendrix biopic with Andre 3000 that came out, and it didn't have the music. And so, you know,
yeah,
and when I'd heard for years that this was coming, I was...
That.
Yeah, you know, you can't do it. How can you do it without the music? And so no, if that had the music, I mean, Andre was 3000 was just the perfect choice for Hendrix. And yet, that came and went. And I think it was purely down to that. If you need the music, you can't do it without it. But so that was, I remember hearing about that on another interview you did. And that was sort of a fist pump moment. I mean, it was for me, so it must have been kind of huge for you when you got that confirmation.
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. And, you know, McCartney actually sent us a note saying how much he liked the graphic novel and liked the way we treated Brian and loved the art. And, you know, to get a note from Paul McCartney that he liked something I did was another one of those life-changing moments.
Incredible, yeah.
And I can actually tell you, I can't give out names yet, but we have actually cast our Brian.
Oh, wow.
So within the next several months, we'll be able to announce, you know, who's playing Brian. And I suspect within the next few months, we'll also be able to announce what network we're going to be on. So it really is moving forward. You know, if any of your listeners would like to get breaking news on that, you can follow us on Twitter at Fifth Beatle. We're also on Facebook at The Fifth Beatle. And we have a website, fifthbeatle.com, with a mailing list. And we, as I said, within the next several months, we will be making those announcements.
Brilliant. I'm so excited for that.
I am. You know, we were doing it as a film for a number of years. And to me, the television format just gives, on a creative note, it just gives me more of a canvas to play with. You know, I've been studying Brian's life since you know, 1992, you know, so well over 20 years. And so the idea of having 6 hours to tell his story as opposed to two is very, very exciting. And it's such a big story that ties into,
of course,
you know, the 60s and the birth of the psychedelic era and the story of the Beatles. But I think there's a lot to tell. So to me, the the miniseries format feels right. I also feel that some of the most exciting dramatic work is being done on television right now.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of what we're doing. I mean, I do know that there are some other folks who've been trying to get a Brian Epstein film off the ground. So, you know, I don't know if any of those are actually happening. The last I heard, the other projects were sort of stalled. But it's quite possible that over the next few years you'll be seeing a lot of Brian in the media. And I hope so. To me, the more people who care about him, the better.
No, that's good. I mean, it's just bizarre how the industry goes, isn't it? You end up getting these competing projects. So, you know, that happened with that Truman Capote. Two films came out in the same year. And then even things like the Snow White. There was two Snow White films came out in the same year.
Yeah.
And you think, well, come on, guy. You know, figure it out.
I know.
But
as I said, we're doing a television series, and I'm fairly certain no one else is working on a TV series.
But I think
a film versus a TV show, you may be competing for certain actors, but that isn't real competition. To me, that's complementary.
Absolutely. And it's like you said earlier, I was going to say that, the TV now, is with the streaming services, is where it's at. You know, look at the new American Gods that's come on. Obviously, the comics are being, you know, are absolutely being mined now. You know, whether it's American Gods, Preacher, Walking Dead, as we said, like these are the people. I mentioned a bit of writing for. There's another podcast that a couple of friends of mine do, and I've sort of just do some bits and pieces of writing for their kind of blog. And and one of the things I've sort of talked about on there is that, you know, for years and years and years that they didn't do comics right. You know, you'd get things like the Richard Donner Superman and things like that, but then so many times they would just sort of take, you know, they would just ignore kind of the stories and ignore what worked well for 50, 70 years and then just put something else together, like, you know, the X-Men, you know, in the leather suits and things like this. And you think, oh, come on, just do what works in the comics. It works, you know. And finally, it feels like with The Walking Dead and with things like that, that they're sort of realizing, oh, hold on. Yeah, maybe the reason that these things are successful is because actually, you know, they've thought about this and they've kind of already done it. And I mean, Kevin Smith tells a story of, you know, after Clerks had been successful, and he'd had, you know, there's that moment in Clerks where he talks about Superman and Lois Lane having sex, and then DC said, oh, you're a comic fan, oh, come in, we're going to do a Superman movie. And he says, oh, okay, well, I can write a Superman movie for you if you want, but, you know, DC Comics is right down the hall. Go and speak to John Byrne. You know, go.
Right.
You know, guys have been writing. You know, there's four Superman comics going on right now, all with absolutely brilliant stories that are ready to be adapted. And then the answer was, oh no, those are comics guys. We need a film guy.
It's ridiculous.
But no. So what's really nice is seeing, like, even in Westworld, you know, there were story credits for Ed Brubaker and things like that. And you think, no, hold on, they're accepting now that comic writers are writers, and they're, you know, and with a comic as well, you know, you're going in with not just a script, but a storyboard, right? There you go. We've got it. We've got the visual look of it. We've got, it's all ready to go. Just do that. just put the camera on that.
Yeah.
No, good.
Yeah,
well,
agreed.
Well, I really hope, I'm really looking forward to when that comes out, and obviously we'll do a big...
Thank you so much.
...big plug on it over here.
Thank you so much. I'd love to stay in touch about it. We should have some juicy news to share soon.
Good. I was just going to say, so is there, I mean, you know, if people sort of keep aware of your newsletter and your website and things... You've just constantly got so many plates spinning. It's, you know, so we've got Star Trek, you've got Astronaut Academy. There's sort of so many different projects. There's the Jagged Little Pill musical. I mean, did you want to just let me know kind of what's, you know, what's going on at the moment?
So Jagged Little Pill is a stage musical that I'm adapting currently, based on the Alanis Morissette album. Very excited about that. That's another one that in the next handful of months, possibly in the next handful of weeks, actually, we're going to be announcing. An opening night, our director, our theater, our writer, you know, all those elements are actually in place. We just haven't announced them yet. So please, any listeners who want breaking news on that, please follow us at @TiwariEnt, that's TiwariEnt,
mm-hmm.
on Twitter, or at Tiwari Entertainment Group on Facebook, and our website there is TiwariEnt.com. But what has been announced is that it's Alanis is working very closely on it. It is not her life story, so we are coming up with a new story surrounding the album.
Uh-huh.
And Tom Kitt is doing orchestrations and arrangements, and Tom is the Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning creator of Next to Normal. So we, I can just tell you that the rest of the creative team are equally impressive, and we're excited to be announcing them shortly. And as I said, we will have an opening night next year, so that is very much happening.
And isn't it ironic, don't you think? A little too ironic. And yeah, I really do think it's like rain.
Alanis Morissette and her 90s mega hit album, Jagged Little Pill, is coming back, this time to a stage production, a new musical based on the angst-filled album will debut next May in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Oscar winner Diablo Cody and Tony winner Diane Polis have also signed on to that project.
Wow, I can't wait.
There's a lot of emotion in there. It's
going to
be.
I'll tell you, it's going to be dark, happy, sad,
exactly.
Emotional.
It's ironic, yeah.
Oh, very ironic, okay.
And then the third project that I'm working on is I'm adapting the comic book series Astronaut Academy to television. And Astronaut Academy is probably most easily described as being as Harry Potter in space. That's basically what it is. It is more original than that. I mean, it's not exactly Harry Potter in space, but that's the general idea. And you can imagine with sort of a tagline like that, we're getting a lot of interest within the industry.
Yeah.
The books are beloved here in the U.S., and so I'm writing the pilot script for that myself. I'm just about done with the pilot script, and we'll be taking that out to networks soon too. So if anybody wants more news on that, Tewarient is also the place to go.
Fantastic. And I mean, is it difficult for you to sort of, you know, have all these different things on the go? Or I suppose it's the nature of the industry that, you know, that these things too gestate for such a long time that you've got to have lots of things on the go. Otherwise, you know, you just sit around waiting for one thing to happen. It just might not happen.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you kind of, you know, in this world, it does behoove you to have a few things going. And yeah, there are times where you know, some effort for each project all has to happen at the same time, and life gets a little bit hectic. But you know, but it's also, I mean, how lucky am I that that's what I do every day? You know,
amazing.
I feel incredibly blessed. Mm-hmm. So to me, it never feels stressful. It just feels like such a joy. And the days that are busy, you know, I just try to take that step back and be grateful, be able to say, like, I'm very lucky that this is what I'm so hectic with. You know, I'm trying to secure Beatles music, and I'm, you know, having a creative conversation with Alanis Morissette, and then I've got to carve out a few hours to write the script for Astronaut Academy. It's like, what a great day that is. You know, I live for those days.
That's amazing.
You
and know? So it doesn't sound like you're going to have to go back to accountancy or being a doctor. That's great.
It doesn't look like it. It doesn't look like it. And I have to say, my family is now very proud and very supportive. God bless them.
Good. So, I mean, so a big part of what Brian did for the Beatles was the style, right?
Yes.
They had the completely different look. They had this sort of greaser look and the jet black hair, and obviously Astrid had been involved in kind of working the sort of the more kind of beatnik-y hairbrush forward look. But it was Brian that came in that really changed everything, put them in the matching suits and, you know, the Beatle boots and all that kind of stuff. And that was such an important part, you know, of it. And so I thought, well, who better than to judge a competition on who is the best dressed man in music as the ultimate expert on Brian Epstein, who was the expert having the best dressed, you know, making this group the best dressed group in music. So, I mean, first off, is there anyone...
I certainly don't have the fashion sense Brian has, but I'll do my best.
So is there anyone, who do you feel personally that when you look at, when you look at sort of the music of the last sort of, you know, couple of decades, is there anyone that jumps out of you as being particularly stylish?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, the styles have changed so much over the years, you know. I mean, I can't claim to be a huge Justin Timberlake fan, but I think that he really does exude a certain confidence and style that's impressive.
He does, yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. I'm not, as the Kinks once sang, a dedicated follower of fashion. So I think you may be asking the wrong guy.
Fair enough. Well, I'll I mean, so we put it out there, and we got loads and loads of responses, which is absolutely brilliant. And yeah, effectively, what it came down to was that the two kind of the two choices that got the most, I think they ended up getting probably about 10 or 15 responses each. And I'm sorry if your Twitter timeline's been absolutely inundated with kind of people talking about Liam Gallagher and Paul Weller and things over the last few days.
Yeah, no, I love that. But what a joy! So.
But yeah, that's what it's come down to. It's come down to Liam Gallagher and Paul Weller. They both
Liam
got
and Paul.
They both got the best response. They got the most responses. So out of and then my favorite response as well from anyone was I'm not going to find his name in time, so I'll drop it in a minute. But this person said Charlie Watts, drummer of the Rolling Stones. Always looked impeccable and had to stare at Mick's spandex-clad ass for 50 years.
Well, that's a good response. I mean, if we're judging the contest based on reasons, you know, I think that may win.
Yeah. So I loved that. That was my favorite response. And then so it was that. It was going to be that or Liam or Paul Weller. But if you're happy to go with the Charlie Watts comic response, then I think that might just deserve a supernova scarf.
I think for creativity points, we should give it to Charlie.
Wonderful.
I think for creativity points, although that it's a tough one, you know, because they're all three very, very different. I mean, Liam has that kind of he definitely has a ton of style, but in a very kind of you know, devil may care kind of style.
Sure.
Whereas Paul is very put together, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe we split it down the middle and give it to Charlie for having to stare at the spandex.
Wonderful. Okay, well, that's absolutely
But
brilliant.
Paul and Liam certainly are deserving of the nods, too.
Yeah, no, they're very, very, very well-dressed gentlemen. And it's just a shame that kind of, you know, I'm just waiting for kind of the next. What's interesting is we're waiting for kind of the next Britpop band or the next sort of, you know, band to come through that have got that real sense of style. I mean, the only person, I don't know if you're aware of Miles Kane, who's that from?
Sure.
I think he's really got that style. He always looks immaculate,
you know,
as well. He got a few shouts.
No question. I was very lucky. I got to see a Last Shadow Puppets show.
Oh, right.
Here in New York a handful of months ago. And that's another one that was like, you know, it was at what I suspect compared to where they would play in the UK would be considered a small club.
Sure.
But you're absolutely right. Miles knows how to strut his stuff in every way. I
mean, he does.
That guy, he's
a cool guy. Good. So
guy, go on. Actually, just a really, really sweetheart of a guy. Oh, he's also just a sweetheart of a guy. I got to spend some time with him and Alex that evening, and they were both really lovely guys.
Oh, wonderful. That's good. Great. I just wanted to really thank you for your time again. I mean, that's absolutely brilliant. Great to speak to you. And I just want to wish you all the best with it. I'm obviously, we'll stay in touch on Twitter and things, and then and I just can't wait to hear the news on the fifth Beatle. I just can't wait to see it on my TV screen.
Thank you so much. I will absolutely keep in touch. I'll let you know about all the latest developments with the projects, and I'd love to come back on the podcast anytime you think we've got enough new news that your listeners will be interested. So let's absolutely stay in touch.
That's great. Now, is there an Oasis track that's a particular favorite for you that you'd like to play out the show now?
Oh, you know, I mean, it's probably not the most creative answer, but Don't Look Back in Anger to me is just a masterpiece of songwriting, production, and performance. So that's the one for me.
Great. Okay. So we'll play out with that. But once again, thank you so much for your time. And everyone listening, if you've never picked up a comic book before, number one, you're completely wrong, because it is the best medium out there. And go and get The Fifth Beatle, because it's an absolute masterpiece and one of the greatest pieces of work about the Beatles in any format. So go and get it.
It's very kind of you to say. Thank you.
Right. All the best. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Look forward to speaking again.
Bye-bye.
Don't Look Back in Anger, singing that, did that make a big difference to you? Kind of singing the song and getting that song recognised and not, admired and loved?
Not at the time. At the time, it was just another song on our second album. Honestly, as the years have gone by, it's like that song is now more important than I'll ever be. You know, there's footage on the internet now of people singing it in Manchester, Candles and all that. And, you know, it's kind of, it is incredible to think that a few generations now have attached some kind of importance to that song. There was mine, and it was passed on to another generation, and that song now has become a hymn to something or other. You know, I still play it, whether I play it acoustically to 100 competition winners or I play it to 70,000 people at a festival. It still works. There's not many songs you can say that about. I certainly can't say that about all my songs. And you do sit there sometimes and think, you know, I'd probably only have to introduce it and play the first chord. I could probably walk off then and nobody'd notice. You know, because there's just people with their eyes shut, you know, crying and stuff. And it's like a, it's an amazing thing. You know, it's something I never kind of take for granted either, you know.
Does it make you feel humbled? Can Noel Gallagher feel humbled?
It makes me feel. Is it proud the word I'm looking for? I don't ever sit there and think, no, I wrote that, you know. I think it came from somewhere else. I think it was a song that was there somewhere, and if I hadn't written it, Bono would have wrote it. You know, it's like those great songs, One and Let It Be. And yeah, I did just compare myself to Paul McCartney there for a second. You know, all it, you know, they're there. You know, if they fall out of the sky and land on your lap, then lucky you.